Okay, we're on deck now with Dr. Adana Grandison. She'll be your presenter this evening for the Better Health Radio Show after a little bit of technical hiccup. We're ready and roaring to go, and of course, she has a guest to bring to you, so let's not keep her back any further and say a special good evening to the good doctor and her guest. Good evening, doctor.
Good evening, Gregson. Good evening to our wider Barbadian public. Thanks again, Gregson, for having us back. Yes, with the increasing advances in technology, sometimes we have more glitches, yep. But all in all, we're here. So I say that to say we can go ahead and start and take it in a positive light. This evening, I want to say a very special thanks to all our listeners throughout Barbados who continue to listen to our show. And this evening, we have a very interesting guest. His name is Dr. Dale Springer. Dr. Springer is a consultant in general and breast surgery at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. He's also a lecturer in general surgery at the University of West Indies Cape Hill campus. Dr. Springer is a medical director of Innovative Surgery Center, which he established in 2019. The primary focus of the center is to advance and provide high quality, evidence-based, patient-centered care to surgical patients, especially those with breast conditions in Barbados and the wider Caribbean. Dr. Springer graduated from the Common Merit School in 1997 and was awarded a Barbados scholarship in that year. He went on to study medicine at the University of the West Indies Mona campus in 1998. He successfully completed his MBBS or his medical degree in 2003. After this, Dr. Springer completed an 18-month internship split between the Kingston Public Hospital in Jamaica and the Queen Elizabeth Hospital in Barbados. After finishing his internship, Dr. Springer joined the Department of Surgery at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital, where he pursued his Doctor of Medicine or DM exam qualification, in general surgery. Dr. Springer completed his DM in 2014, and after this, he continued to work in the Department of Surgery at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital as a senior registrar. He's very passionate about advancing the treatment of patients with breast cancer and other breast conditions, which led him to pursue his fellowship. In 2018, Dr. Springer successfully completed a one-year clinical fellowship in breast and endocrine surgery at the first affiliated hospital in Chongqing Medical University in Chongqing, China, with special focus on oncoplastic breast surgery, breast conserving surgery, and reconstructive breast surgery. Dr. Springer is also a fellow and an active member of the Caribbean College of Surgeons. Dr. Springer's research interests include locally advanced breast cancer, triple negative breast cancer, and cancer distress. He is also very passionate about teaching and training of medical students and future general surgeons. He's currently in the process of establishing a specialist breast clinic at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital and is dedicated to promoting awareness about breast cancer, early detection, and empowering patients to manage their health. Good evening and welcome, Dr. Springer.
Good evening, Dr. Grandison. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great. Now, this evening, I want to remind our listeners across Barbados that should they wish to call in and speak with Dr. Springer, ask him any questions, that they can feel free to do so at 434-1790. Again, that number is 434-1790. And I believe Gregson or WhatsApp is available to us. And that number is 266-4862. Again, 266-4862 for those persons who are probably just a little shy and don't want to hear their voice on the radio, but they can still send their questions. Now, Dr. Springer, this month was Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And Barbados, just like many other countries across the world, we opted to celebrate and bring awareness to breast cancer. And we had our breast cancer walk on the 1st of October. I want to first start off with discussing a bit about the theme for breast cancer awareness in 2023, because I thought it was a very interesting theme and it goes quite hand in hand with what we know in terms of the overall mantra for breast cancer awareness, for medical practice, I should say, throughout the world, which is no one should face breast cancer alone. And when we think about medical practice, we've moved away from a paternalistic way of practicing medicine and really asking for doctors and patients to coexist in a partnership where patients have an equal buy-in in terms of their management for their overall illness. And I thought this was a very interesting theme that you had. But I want you to start off this evening by first of all telling us about why is breast cancer screening important? Because we're going to have a lot to talk about this evening, but I think that that's probably one of the most important points that we want to talk about this evening. But why is breast cancer screening so important?
Right. So let's start. Let's first define what screening is.
Right.
So screening is looking for a condition, a disease in a patient who is asymptomatic. By that, I mean they have no symptoms, they have no complaints whatsoever. They're doing well. They have no concerns about the area. So for breast cancer, they have no concerns about their breasts, no problems with their breasts. They're fine. So screening is when we undergo that process to try to look to see if there is any condition there. Yes, and it's a process, not a one-off event. It's a process that it is ongoing between the patient and the physician. Yeah, so it's important because screening helps us to detect cancers at an earlier stage, and some of them we can even detect before they become invasive, which means the ability to spread. So we can detect them so early, they're just confined to the breast. And in these situations, when we detect cancer early, the likelihood of curing it is higher. Also, the treatments are less intensive in some cases with earlier detection. So I think screening is very important, especially for our population like ours, in terms of detecting these cancers early, so we can treat them and have good results.
Excellent. And I am very happy that you really highlighted the fact that persons who are undergoing screening, it's not because you have detected a lump in your breast or that you know there's cancer there. It's that person that has absolutely no symptoms at all. And so I am going to move on to my next question, because I'm going to sort of take a step back and then come forward. My next question would be this. When should a female start breast examinations on herself? When should a young lady start to become aware of her breasts, know her breasts, understand the architecture of her breasts? And I will take it even a step further to ask, when should a person, because we often think of breast cancer being confined only to a female, but we also know that males can have breast cancer. So when should a person be aware of their breasts?
Yeah, so breast awareness is very important. It is form part of the screening process. I would say it's not set age that we have to be aware of the breasts. So even teenagers and going forward, they can be aware of their breasts, what their breasts normally look like, what they normally feel like. That's what self-breast awareness is, to have that baseline, what is normal for you. And that should be encouraged from as young as possible. Teenagers coming all up to the early 20s. Yes, when you get a little older, then we will start getting into the formal processes of screening and investigations and so forth. And this depends on your, not only your age, but your risk of breast cancer. But breast awareness is something that everyone needs to be aware of, even men, I would say. Obviously, breast cancer is much less common in men, but men may still have some symptoms that can be attributable to breast cancer. So for that reason, if they feel a lump in their breast that is not normal, they should also be aware that it's something that could be serious and get it checked out.
Great. Now, you spoke about a lump in the breast, and I know that there are several occasions where persons may feel a lump in the breast. And before we go on to speak about who gets breast cancer, I know that a lot of persons, from the time they feel a lump in the breast, they become very concerned. But a lump in the breast does not always and immediately signify breast cancer. Am I correct?
Yes. Yes, Dr. Ross, you're definitely correct. And in fact, the majority of breast lumps in both males and females are not cancerous, what we will call benign. They're not cancer. So about 85% to 90% of these lumps will not be cancer. There are many benign conditions such as breast cysts, which are filled with fluid and become tense. We can feel them. Sometimes lymphomas of the breast, which is just a growth of fat in the breast, or fibroadenoma, which is just overgrowth of the breast tissue, we can feel, or fat necrosis, which is basically scarring of the fat in the breast, which commonly follows trauma to the breast, can cause lumps in the breast. In males, it may just be gynecomastia, which is benign, a benign enlargement of the breast tissue in the male. So the majority of the times, the lumps are benign, but still, we would always recommend a person who has a new lump in the breast to get it checked, because just from history or just from knowing about it or describing how the person touching it, you can't tell for sure it's benign. So we always recommend that they see their breast surgeon and have it evaluated and checked, even though the odds are it's benign.
Great. So Dr. Spring, who is really at risk of developing breast cancer?
Right. So I would say everyone is at risk, yes, but obviously you have varying degrees of risk. Mm-hmm. So over the lifetime of a woman, for example, the average risk is 1 in 8 or 12.5%. And we tend to see this in older women, yes? So it's after in the 50s and getting older, we tend to see the majority of cancers. But does not mean that younger patients can't have breast cancer. So unfortunately, we have some cases of women in their 40s, their 30s, and even their 20s, but this will be in the minority of cases, whereas the majority of these cancers will be seen in older patients. Similarly, in men, it tends to be much less incidence of breast cancer, much less occurrence. So for every 100 women that get breast cancer, we will have approximately one man, and these also tend to be in the older age group.
Okay. Is there any particular pattern, let's say, for the female, which may put her at increased risk of developing breast cancer?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. In terms of risk factors for breast cancer in females, there are many risk factors. Some of them that we can change, so we call those modifiable ones, and then some that we cannot change. So those are the non-modifiable ones. So some non-modifiable ones, for example, are being female, getting older, so age. As we said, just to recap, you see cancer more commonly in females over the age of 50. Also, women who started to have their period before the age of 12, who experience menarche after the age of 55. They also have an increased risk for breast cancer, and this has to do with the number of periods they are exposed to, and the amount of estrogen mainly that they're exposed to throughout their lifetime, the cumulative effect of estrogen throughout their lifetime. Another major risk factor that's non-modifiable is the genetic risk factor. And we see in persons who have a family history of close relatives, and by close relatives, we mean first degree relatives such as a mother, a sister, a daughter, or a father or brother who have breast cancer. These persons are increased risk if they have these relatives, and the more relatives they have that have cancer, breast cancer, the greater their risk, the greater the magnitude of their risks are. Yeah. And it speaks to the underlying genetic predisposition, and there are some genes that predispose to breast cancer that we normally would check for. These are the BRCA1 and BRCA2 genes. Yeah, so these are non-modifiable risk factors. But then some important modifiable risk factors that we have for breast cancer are being overweight, smoking of cigarettes, consumption of excess alcohol, living a sedentary lifestyle, meaning not exercising too much and not being physically active. Yeah. These are also some modifiable risk factors that do contribute to developing breast cancer. And good thing about them is, as they are called modifiable, they are things that we can do to try to basically change them in a positive way, to impact them in a positive way. Whereas for the non-modifiable ones and genetic ones, we cannot. So it's good, if possible, to exercise, to try to maintain an adequate weight, to avoid cigarette smoking and avoid excessive consumption of alcohol as well.
Now, I'm very glad, Dr. Springer, you spoke about family history, because certainly within the Barbadian context, and I'll probably take it a little wider, the Caribbean context, knowing a family history is usually something that we keep very private, or historically, Barbadians have kept medical family history very quiet within the family. Persons often see a disease process as something to be hidden and not something to be shared with their immediate family. And not only can it assist in terms of the coping with of this new disease process, but more importantly, it can also save lives, simply because now your family members, your siblings, the offspring of your siblings, your offspring, all of these persons are now at increased awareness, and so they will undertake and should undertake screening at a lot earlier age, with possibly the hope of getting a positive outcome and being able to identify breast cancer at a lot earlier time. Dr. Springer, so what are some of the symptoms, given the fact that not all lumps are considered malignant or cancerous breast lumps? What are some of the symptoms of breast cancer?
Right. So in terms of the symptoms of breast cancer, and these come up, and these are very important, because when persons are being aware of their breasts and they're doing the examinations, these are things that they will also be looking for. So one of the things you can see is a change in the size or the shape of the breasts. One may become bigger than the other one, or one may become smaller. That is something that is concerning. The two breasts normally are not the same size. You usually will have one that is slightly bigger than the next in the same individual. And persons will know that from the time they know themselves, that is how they help me. But I've been noticing a change in that. That is concerning. Also, if you can see or feel a lump in the breast or in the armpit or the axilla, as we call it medically, that is also concerning. If your skin changes, such as redness of the skin of the breast or rashes to the breast, that is also a change that could be concerning. Also, if there's a change in the position of the nipple, most persons would have a nipple that extends outward. The minority of patients will have a nipple that is retracted. But if you are a person whose nipple always was protruding and then it starts to go in and become retracted, that is also concerning. Or if you have a spontaneous discharge from the nipple, so not you squeeze the breast, but if it comes out spontaneously, especially if it's bloodstained, that is also a concerning symptom that could indicate underlying breast malignancy.
Okay, great. So Dr. Springer, I'm going to just pause you right here at this point in time, because I think we have our first caller for this evening. Okay.
Yes, hi. Great evening. How are you?
Good evening.
Hey, good evening.
Fine, thank you. And you?
Yes, God bless. Wonderful. Well, I love you for blessing me with your presence, and thank you that all my blessings come from you, and we bless when I can curse. Good evening to the good doctor, and thank Gregson for taking my call. I'm really appreciative for this discussion this evening, because it teaches me a lot about stuff that I really don't know, that I really never took the interest, but you've made it so interesting with the wonderful questions. I appreciate it. Let me add some of my own blessings to the program as well. Now, my first question has to do with the particular breast massage where you have some of these undergarments, and especially some of these exercise undergarments that women usually, women that usually have breast support. So, you would find breast massage being very good and so on, but when they're dealing with these tight, what we call undergarments, bras, and then they go running and so on, and they want to look good, so they want men to see them going up and down all the time, this kind of thing. How important is it to stop that and to be able to wear the proper breast support needed for the breast to remain, to stay up, but not really to stay up, but to have the longevity throughout the course of life, so that you don't get the cancer in the first place? My second question has to do with breastfeeding, and we know that when a woman breastfeeds, I mean, she's able to have a nice long life, and then in her childhood, well, her, in her ability to have a child before menopause, it can lengthen the life of the breast and so on, and keep the breast nice and toned and textured and everything. It really helps the woman tremendously. How important is having kids and especially breastfeeding in relation to breast cancer as juxtaposed to not having any children and not really engaging, even having another spouse, just living a single life, solitary and so on, and you're doing nothing for the breast. In terms of the difference with that, which life do you think, or which purpose is better for the breast itself to avoid, as I said, as I would have mentioned, breast cancer? My other question has to do with the breast and how it is supported via the cause of the fat when you're talking about avoiding breast cancer and avoiding men having breast cancer. I turn to myself. What is the major or the main cause for a man to get breast cancer? Is it genetic? Is it black? Me being that particular color, and how? In other words, why is it that men can get breast cancer? Too, I thought, you know, you would always thought, and most people think that men really would hardly ever get breast cancer or not. I'm just asking the main cause for their benefit, because you know you will know that it is possible and it is true that men can have breast cancer just like women. And my final question very quickly. Now, in terms of having your breast support in terms of a young woman growing into womanhood and her breast being bigger and so on, and she's wearing these nipple piercings. The nipple piercings are really not good, we know, because you're training to go back to one of my other questions in terms of breastfeeding. So when not to use these particular nipple type piercings that pierce the breast, and then you know you have that particular drag on the breast and so on, but these weighted piercings for the breast. Thank you. You've brought healing to my soul. Thank you very much, Sharon. I love you into your growth.
Thank you very much. And I think I'm going to start the questions this evening, Dr. Spram, probably because I wrote them down. I always like to write down my questions so that I have them. Yep. Just want to make sure. I think the first question, I'll take the breastfeeding one first.
Yeah.
What risk or reduction of risk is associated with breastfeeding?
Right. So breastfeeding is one of the protective factors for breast cancer. Yeah. And it's usually recommended if you can breastfeed for a year, it can actually decrease your risk by about 4%. Yes. They think that because of the increased metabolic activity of the breasts when you're producing milk, it causes turnover of the cells more rapidly and the removal of damaged cells. So it actually is a protective factor, yes, for breast cancer.
Is it breastfeeding or is it breast sucking and breast stimulation? Because I heard that he asked a question, is there also a role that the spouse may play in terms of ensuring to reduce that risk?
No, it's actually breastfeeding and the production of milk. And you would also note that oftentimes when women are breastfeeding, they are not having a period, so menstruation ceases. And that also decreases the amount of estrogen cycles that the person is exposed to. And we mentioned that's one of the risk factors for breastfeeding. But sucking on the breasts is not a risk factor for breast cancer, and it does not really provide any protective benefit for preventing breast cancer in the current medical literature.
Okay, and the second question would be, in terms of support, sports bras, other types of bras, whether they have underwear or they don't, how important is it to support the breast, especially when undertaking exercise? Is it important? Does it contribute if you don't have on adequate support? Does it contribute any additional risk to the possibility and increase the risk of developing breast cancer later on in life?
No. So the undergarments do not play any role in developing breast cancer. Some people speculated about the underwear and the bra being a risk factor, and by wearing bras with underwear that can increase your risk. But there's no evidence that we have right now that suggests that. So women can feel free to wear whatever undergarments they would desire, be it sports bras, regular bras, whatever they choose. It does not increase the risk of breast cancer. I would speculate that they would choose undergarments that are comfortable if they're exercising to provide support. Others may opt not to wear for their comfort, and that's perfectly fine. It's the woman's choice. And none of these things would affect their risk of breast cancer.
Any additional risks with piercings or instrumentation to the breast and nipples?
No, for breast cancer, no. That would not increase your risk either for breast cancer. Yes, sometimes though, with the piercings, there is a small risk of increase of infections in the breast. Yes, and sometimes persons may develop keloids to the nipple or the skin of the breast, which they pierce. These are what people call growing flesh or overgrowth of the scar. So this can happen with piercings. And if you do have a piercing, it is very advisable to remove it before you start breastfeeding.
Great. And the final question, which I actually thought was a very interesting question, really, what is the main cause of men getting breast cancer?
Right. So this goes back to, I think, the fundamental cause for all cancers is genetics, yes, and then also the interplay of environmental factors, some of which we alluded to, such as lifestyle, diet, and these kind of things. In men, though, you would also see the BRCA1 and 2 mutations, the genetic mutations. They have a genetic abnormality that they're born with that predispose them, or that through life, because of their experiences, the lifestyle factors, they acquire some genetic mutation that causes breast cancer to develop. So it mainly comes back to genetics in the individual. And so these mutations are unpredictable. We cannot predict who will acquire them. It's just the way we are made as humans. So I think that's it for male breast cancer as well. BRCA-related and then sporadic mutations, the true lifestyle.
Now, we spoke about, getting back to some of the questions that we were answering earlier, we spoke about the fact that a breast can happen, a lump, and that is, may signal, or for instance, a lump in the underarm or the axilla, and that may signal someone to really investigate to see if they do have cancer. But I'm very happy that you highlighted the other things to look at, the skin changes, if the breasts are shaped differently, if something happens to the nipple, it becomes introverted. And certainly if it is that for instance, there's any discharge coming from the nipple, because a breast does not need to have a lump in order for a breast cancer to be present. Is that correct?
Yes, that is most definitely correct. Yes. So these changes are within the tissue of the breast, but they're not a lump that you can see or feel. And that comes back to screening, having screening examination, because you're not having any symptoms, but it is there. So these kind of cases can be detected with screening examinations. These are just having these abnormalities. Sometimes it's just cells on the breast, so it hasn't even reached the stage of invasive cancer. They are precancerous lesions, which would have progressed in some cases to become cancer that you can detect.
And one other question around symptoms surrounding breast cancer. Does breast cancer hurt? Because a lot of persons may think, my breasts are not hurting me, so I can't have breast cancer.
Right. So majority of the times, breast cancer is painless. Yes. So yes, it's painless in the majority of things. But in some cases, it can be painful. In a condition that we call inflammatory breast cancer, The breast can be painful. And the thing about this condition, it mimics or it tries to basically appear like an infection of the breast, what we call a mastitis or an abscess. Yes, so the breast will be red, it will be warm, it will be hot and tender. And sometimes it can fool persons that this is actually an infection and not cancer. So in those cases, that patients who have that condition, the breast can be painful and yet still can be a cancer. So it comes in all forms and sizes and varieties. So yes, it can be painful or it can be painless. So it comes back again to once you have a lump in the breast, it is very important to have an evaluation by your breast surgeon.
All right, doctors, let me just interrupt you here. That seems like a great segue for this query I have here. A couple of queries. This first one says, what does burning in the breast signify? So I guess since you're on that topic, you can address that one if you don't mind, please.
Yeah, so there are many causes for burning in the breast. Yeah, a lot of times it may just be due to fibrocystic changes, which are usually on the background of the hormonal fluctuations in the person's body. Yeah, it could be due to dermatological conditions. Rarely it could be due to cancer. So as I will always say, if you have a concern about these things, it's always important to get his checked up. Yeah, it sometimes during the evaluation it may actually come up that there is an underlying malignancy or it would be something benign. Right? Sometimes patients present with these burning. Majority of times it turns out to be benign. A benign condition. Sometimes it's something we can't put a finger on, but sometimes it does coexist with a cancer of the breast. So the important point is to get an evaluation first to exclude malignancy and then try to find what else could be the cause causing it.
Okay. All right. This next one says, what is the best form of screening?
Right. That's an excellent question. Thank you very much. So the best form of screening depends on your risk for breast cancer. So we'll start with the average risk person. Who is at average risk? Yes. So we would normally, in those patients, recommend a mammogram starting at the age of 40 and going every year or every other year. Yes. At the least. So a screening interval of 1 year. Or some persons prefer to do it every other year. These are persons who are average risk. Yes. Here in Barbados, we tend though to recommend more so doing it yearly, but some guidelines do recommend 2 yearly intervals. But we here tend to recommend, at least in my practice, I tend to recommend it yearly. So these are persons who are average risk. Persons who are high risk, who have had a genetic test that show they have a genetic predisposition to breast cancer, or they've had breast cancer before, and we are following those up. If they are at high risk, then we still do the mammograms every year, but we may include a breast MRI as well. And we alternate them. So each test is alternated. So they're getting an investigation every 6 months because for these patients at high risk. And these are persons who are at a lifetime risk of 20% or more for breast cancer. So these are the screening intervals for the average person and the high-risk person. And high-risk screening can start from the early to mid-20s, whereas for average-risk persons, we would normally start at the age of 40 in terms of doing the investigations. But they will be having discussions with their general practitioners, their breast surgeon, from the time they're in the 20s about breast health, also their family history. So if you see that they have a strong family history of breast cancer, then they can be introduced into a screening program at an earlier age. I hope I have answered the question.
All right. I've got a couple more here for you. This one says, good evening, Dr. Springer. What advice would be given to a patient with BRCA1 and BRCA2 positive genetic testing? If you want me to pause and you respond to that one.
Yeah. Let me take that one and then we can move on.
All right.
Right. So BRCA1 and BRCA2, just for the information for the general public, in case they may not know, these are genes that predispose you to breast cancer. These are what we call high penetrant genes. Yes, and they have, if you have these genes, you can have a lifetime risk of breast cancer that goes up to about 80%. I remember we said the average risk person has a risk of 12.5%. Yes, so these are persons who have these risks. And you will see one of the most famous persons you may have heard of is Angelina Jolie, who has these genes. Yes, and she opted to have prophylactic surgery, removal of the breasts and the ovaries. So in terms of answer the question that was asked now more specifically, if you have these genes, then it depends on the age. In a young person who has these genes, we would enter them first into a high-risk screening program, as we outlined just now, where we would do the breast MRI and the mammogram every 6 months to have an investigation done. And once they have completed their family, then we would recommend the prophylactic surgery. If they should develop a breast cancer before that time, then we would recommend surgery. And because a mastectomy is a type of surgery, and because they have a genetic predisposition, we would recommend a bilateral mastectomy in these cases. If it's an older person who has these genes and they have not developed breast cancer, but they are found to have the genetic predisposition, because risk of the cancer accumulates over time, in those cases, for older patients with these genetic predispositions, we may be more inclined to enter them into a high-risk screening program as opposed to offer them surgery. But it's all about shared decision-making in terms of discussing with the patient what the options are as the care provider, and then the patient and you come into a decision about a treatment option that they feel comfortable to pursue. So the younger patients, once they're finished their family, we would offer them prophylactic surgery. The older patients may just go into a screening program. We have an older person, but it says, hey, I would prefer to have the surgeries. We would go ahead and offer that in those situations. So again, it's very individualized.
Okay, this next one asks, what is the prognosis for those with triple negative breast cancer, and does tumor markers provide any guide in the treatment process?
Right, so let's start with the last question first, the tumor markers. So yes, that is almost like the holy grail of treating breast cancer, because we have moved on to not just seeing breast cancer, but we want to know what type of cancer it is. So we have three biomarkers that we normally check for routinely. This the estrogen receptor, the progesterone receptor, and the HER2 receptor. Yes, so these receptors basically are on the cancer cells. And when the person's cancer in the blood, the hormones in the person's blood comes in contact with the cancer, it would cause the cancer to grow. So example, if you have estrogen receptors on your cancer cell, when estrogen comes in contact with the receptor, that can cause these cancers to grow. Similarly for progesterone and HER2, it's the same principle. So the biomarkers are very important, because we can also use that to treat cancer. We can give medications now to stop these hormones from reaching these receptors, and that can cause the cancer to regress. So that's very important. Then the person asks, so triple negative breast cancer and the prognosis. So that actually comes about from the biomarkers. So the biomarkers are negative in triple negative breast cancer. The three hormone receptors that we just talked about, the person's cancer doesn't have any of those receptors on the cancer cell. So that's why it's called triple negative. And this tends to be a more aggressive type of cancer. Yes. But having said that, it responds very well to chemotherapy as well. And prognosis now has to do with the stage of the cancer as well. So you can have an early stage breast cancer as triple negative, the prognosis may still be very good. And you can have a more advanced stage one where the prognosis may not be as good. Similarly, you can have an early stage triple negative cancer, but then a more advanced hormone receptor positive cancer. And the one that has more advanced stage will have a less favorable prognosis, even though the earlier stage one is a more aggressive type. So it's very difficult then to say individually for a patient sometimes what your prognosis would be, even though we would use the stage groupings and the category to give a rough idea. But prognosis to then give an individual patient sometimes is quite difficult based on the type of cancer.
Okay, another one for you, if you don't mind, Dr. Granderson.
No, not ahead. Right. I think that the patients are peeping at my paper of questions. So I'm quite happy to let them go. Go ahead.
All right, this one asks, it says, good evening. How does one know if she is high risk?
Right, so in terms of the risks for breast cancer, the things that we discussed earlier, the risk factors that we discussed earlier, one of the main ones would be the family history, as Dr. Granson spoke about at the beginning, and you have multiple first-degree relatives with breast cancer that can put you at high risk for breast cancer. If you have a genetic predisposition, if you were tested and have a genetic predisposition, that would put you at high risk. And if you have many of your risk factors, those can always put you at high risk. In terms of formal risk assessment, though, there are certain algorithms and tables that we would use when we see an individual patient that will consider these things. We also consider if you had a previous breast biopsy and it has shown a pre-malignant lesion, these things as well. But the majority of those risk tables and the calculations have to do with family history and having close family members with breast cancer. That's what the main risk factors that would increase a person's risk for breast cancer. Obviously that, and having had a diagnosis with breast cancer in the past.
Okay, thank you. All yours, Dr. Grandison.
Great. So Dr. Springer, you spoke about the hormonal receptor assessment, but I just wanted you very quickly to walk us through from a mammogram or a person either coming in for a screening or them suspecting that they may have breast cancer based upon a lump, and that lump shows some of the features or all of the features on mammography that would suggest that it is quite likely that this person may have breast cancer. Walk us through from that point to possibly your first interventions, depending upon the size of that mass, whether it's going to be surgery or chemotherapy.
Right. So in terms of having had a confirmed diagnosis of breast cancer and you know the type of cancer, the next step is usually to stage that patient to see how far the cancer has spread.
No, Dr. Springer, even before that, so the person has the mammogram, how do you find out that the person has truly breast cancer? Because the imaging is suggesting it.
Walk us through that biopsy process,
because I know a lot of persons are very scared about biopsy.
Yes, let's go about this. You had the abnormal imaging investigation, screening investigation, because screening is not diagnostic. It just says, hey, we need to take a closer look here. So sometimes you see something that is suspicious on the screening examination and we want to know. So that's where the biopsy comes in. And that involves using a small needle to take some samples of the area that is abnormal. And either the mammogram or the ultrasound will guide us to that area that is abnormal. And we take out this tissue. It's a very small needle. It is then on the local anesthetic and the patient goes home the same day. Yes. So it's not a case you come into hospital. It's not going to be getting any cuts or anything. Just a small needle that we use to take some tissue out of the breast. If the lymph nodes are suspicious as well, we will take some tissues from the lymph node and we send it to the lab. And we usually leave a marker after we do the biopsy so we can find out the area. It goes to the lab, then the pathologist looks at it under the microscope. And they will either say, yes, this looks like cancer, or no, this is benign. If it does look like cancer, then we have to go off now and see what type of cancer. So we go back to look at the biomarkers, the estrogen receptor, the progesterone receptor, and the HER2 receptor to see which are positive and which are negative. And then that tells us the type of cancer. And when we get that diagnosis of cancer, we also want to know the stage of the cancer. So then we will do our staging investigations. Yes, the CT, normally we do a CT scan, a CAT scan, which is basically a series of specialized x-rays of the chest, abdomen, and pelvis to stage patients. And patients who have symptoms that suggest that the cancer may have spread to the bone or the brain, we will also do scans to look at these areas to give us the stage of the cancer. And having
so, so really the staging is to look for spread?
Yes.
Great, okay.
And that note tells you how we treat this cancer, once we can stage it. If it is early or late, that will determine the treatment along with the type of cancer. And also, obviously, the patient's genetic predisposition as well will have a role.
So we have performed the mammogram on the patient. They've had a biopsy, whether it's excisional, incisional, or a punch biopsy. And this patient has now gone on to staging. They've had their diagnosis.
Right.
Is this a time to have the discussion solely with the patient? Or should a patient come to the physician at this point in time with possibly a family member, a loved one, someone for support? Is this a wider conversation that needs to happen, or really is this just a conversation for the patient? Because I know it can be quite difficult. Sometimes hearing this news for some persons may be considered bad news. Breaking bad news, quite often patients don't hear it on the first time around. Any importance for support, and what role should family members or loved ones really play at this stage?
Right. That's a very good question, I would say, right? When we see these abnormal things on the mammogram, we always try to sensitize the patient. There's a possibility, right? So when it does come back, if it does come back, seeing that it's cancer, at least they will have had an inkling that this could be existing from before. And then we will let them know as well, if they have a close family friend or a family member that they'd want to, that they can come to appointments with them, yes? And they can come into the doctor's office with them. Because sometimes persons are a bit hesitant to bring persons in, or they're a bit hesitant to come in. But we always encourage family to come in, because it's a team, there's always a team approach. And that person that you have chosen to be walked with you is part of your team. Similarly, when we as physicians are treating breast cancer, we treat it as a team. So yes, I'm a breast surgeon, but I am not the only person on the team. When I'm seeing patients, I have a whole heap of doctors in their specialties working along with me. So it's the same thing for patients. To have that support, it's very important to have that team approach. So if they want to bring one, two persons, that is not a problem. We actually encourage that, because they need that support, because being positive about the treatment is very important.
Great. Now, Dr. Springer, we have heard about national screening programs for colorectal cancer, breast cancer, prostate cancer in other territories. And I have also heard about the fact that you are developing, or in the process of developing, a specialized clinic at the Queen Elizabeth Hospital. How important do you really think it is for us to have possibly a national screening program? Is it really necessary?
Yes.
Should persons continue with, you know, should you choose to, then you go for screening, or should it really be a national screening program?
Yeah, I think that's a very good question. I definitely would support a national screening program to help the process formalize. Yes, so that we have a database of persons in the country, especially women. So when you are coming up to a certain age, whatever age we choose, that you get a letter saying the cancer is here, you can go, you should go and get screening, and then you can opt in and you go and do it. So I know sometimes persons forget, or they say they put it off, but just have these reminders out there, because screening is important because it helps us to detect cancer early, at an earlier stage, and the treatment is less extensive. And unfortunately, we are a small island and we do not have a lot of the money to buy a lot of the fancy medications that are needed in the latter stages of treatment. So if we can get cancers early, we can actually save money by not having to give those medications. So I think a national screening program for breast cancer, colorectal cancer, prostate cancer is something that would be beneficial. Obviously, there will have some negatives to it, but I think the majority of it would be positives, and it would also benefit us as a country in the long run, because prevention is better than a cure.
Thank you. Gregson, yeah. I see that we have a call, but I just want to insert one question while we queue up that call. How important is it for a person to undertake screening, Dr. Springer, after being affected by COVID-19? Because I know that persons after having COVID-19 may have noticed some changes in their bodies. Is this something that really needs to be done? Should we think that this is just any other flu and proceed back to business as usual? Any other additional steps that we need to take?
So this is screening for breast cancer after a COVID-19 diagnosis?
Yes, please.
Yes. You should still go back to your regular screening protocols after you have recovered from the COVID-19. Initially, when the pandemic was at its height and the vaccines, what happened in some places, we noted that the lymph nodes on the site that you received vaccine were becoming swollen, the lymph nodes in the armpit, and that led to a lot of biopsies for persons who were having mammograms and seeing these swollen nodes. So after, I think they recommended that after the vaccine to wait a little bit to give you a chance to settle and then go back to your regular screening and do your mammogram. So you don't have that imaging confusion. But it's very important if you've had COVID-19, once you're recovered, that you would continue your screening.
Great. Gregson, you have a question?
Good evening.
Good evening.
Good evening.
This is Anthony Hope calling to you, Dr. Granderson, and it's Dr. Springer.
Good evening, Mr. Hope.
Sir.
I wasn't able to listen from the beginning. However, there's always something that has eluded me in terms of cancer, and that is the triggering mechanism. Now, when you say it's DNA, I understand that. I don't want to go into the configuration of DNA, but what really triggers the cancer in your body? In this case of the breast cancer, you said, is it the BRA1 or the BRA2 receptor, or is it something that has to be physiological within the cell that disturbs the translation?
Right. So for the BRCA1 and 2, those are tumor suppressor genes. Basically, they help repair DNA, and they do not do their job. So basically, before going into any molecular biology and great details, it just means the DNA, the configuration of the DNA changes, and DNA tells the body what proteins to produce, what to do. So something causes the change. And you have the genes, the predisposition, the genes that predispose you, that can cause it, or it may just be a life, just by living and your exposure to certain things in life, that can cause a change in your DNA. That's what we call sporadic mutations, or just by where your body is, you get a change in the genetic code, and then that tells the body to produce cancer cells as opposed to normal cells. But to put your finger on it and say exactly what triggers it is very difficult. We know there are certain things, particularly like radiation exposure, but most people would not be exposed to radiation, toxic radiation that would cause cancer. But UV radiation can do it.
I don't want to go down this road, but it seems like I'm pushing towards that. You know, in the DNA, they talk about dynamic instability and catastrophe of the microtubules. In this DNA structure, would this also influence the projection of translation to cause a cancerous activity?
So I want to take a step back first in terms of how we first see cancer. I know a lot of persons see cancer as the big monster in the room, but cancer, very simply put, is the unregulated cellular growth. So cells are not being kept in check. We have a very robust check system. And you spoke about the microtubule instability, which causes a translational issue. If there's any error that should occur, there are different types of errors that can occur during the translational process. But if there is an error that occurs, which for any reason would stop that checking mechanism. So Dr. Springer spoke about cancer suppressor genes, tumor suppressor genes. So if, for instance, it changes the configuration of any of those and stop them from doing their job, then yes, it can cause dysregulation. If it is that you have, for instance, a cell that is allowed to continue to replicate without being checked, or it promotes cellular growth at an increased rate, which again is essentially what cancer is, then yes, it can give rise to cancer. But not all translational errors are going to give rise to cancer of any kind.
So that's why I asked if there's something that must trigger it once it's at the translational stage, because there's no one situation that causes cancer. So is there something that can trigger that situation in the body, or it triggers by itself?
So as Dr. Springer said, there are several things that can happen, especially environmental factors. He spoke about one, but also providing an environment of that that would increase inflammation. He spoke about radiation, but he also spoke about the importance of exercise, the importance of not living a sedentary life, the importance of not using alcohol. All of these are things that can contribute, possibly, but it is not as simple as if you do X, Y will occur every single time, because there are some persons who may have consumed alcohol throughout their life, who may have smoked throughout their life, who may not exercise as probably as much as we would like them to, and they do not develop cancer because they have other protective mechanisms in place. So it's not, as Dr. Springer, it's not as simple as saying it, we can pinpoint it and say X and Y. This is an area that continues to undergo research. And I think that the space of cancer research continues to evolve. So I would have to say that it is not a single trigger that you can say. If a person is exposed to standing next to, let's say, Dr. Grandison's radio station, that yes, automatically you will get cancer. It's not as simple as that, Mr. Hope. I wish it were so that we could possibly save everybody, but it's really not as simple as that.
I am aware of that, but that's why I specifically asked that question for the listening audience.
Yes.
You know, my last comment to you is saying that those people who don't get that cancer level, they're probably the guardian angel is working perfect.
Perhaps. Yes, it's a very complex, what we call oncogenesis, is a very complex process. Yes, it's not something that we really can see, we understand 100%. Of it, right. It's not something that we can really put our fingers on and say that even when you get cancer, that you got cancer because of A, B, C, D. Yeah. And some oftentimes when patients come, they have been living a life which I don't want, a life where they were doing what they think they've been doing, everything they're supposed to do, and yet they have this diagnosis. They're saying, what did they do wrong? What caused this? And oftentimes we cannot put our finger and say A, B, C, or D. It's just one of these things, and it's sporadic. And there's so much that we know about the genome and genes, and there's so much that we don't know. It'll be impossible to say with certainty in the majority of cases what is the underlying cause.
Okay, Mr. Hope, go ahead, Doc.
And I think that that's really something to understand, especially from the patients, because sometimes they go into a blame game, blaming themselves. But a lot of the times, it's not that you have done something wrong. You have, it's not that you, because as Dr. Springer said, you have eaten as you should, you've exercised as you should, you've lived a very healthy life, you've tried to reduce all of your risk, and you still can get a diagnosis of cancer. And I really think that we need to move away from seeing it as the monster in the room, and more so being fearful of the monster, but as we have these type of programs, educate ourselves about what really is happening and try to attack the monster and rid the monster from this space.
Okay, Mr. Hope, thank you kindly, and you have a...
I'm really enjoying... Excellent, thank you.
You are very welcome, sir. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Hope.
Yeah, I was trying to get another call there. It was blinking not too long ago, but we seem to have lost that one. So, Dr. Grandison, all over to you.
So, Dr. Springer, because I know in the interest of time, you're a very, very busy person, I wanted for you to give us a few takeaway points, because I know there are some persons who may not have had the opportunity to listen to the entire show. But if you had to summarize exactly from start to finish very quickly, how you would want every single patient possibly addressing the screening, because that's where it all starts, screening for this disease process, what would you say?
I would say, one, definitely be aware of your breaths. It's something that every person can do from a relatively young age. And two, do your screening investigations, go through the process, even though it may be a little daunting sometimes. Don't put it off unnecessarily. Yes. And Territory was saying, Rapna, even though if you are unfortunate enough to be diagnosed with breast cancer, do not see it as a death sentence.
Mm-hmm.
This is a disease that is still very treatable, and you can live a good quality of life with it. So do not see it as a death sentence. Be positive, lean into your support system and fight this condition. And we as physicians, myself as a breast surgeon and my colleagues and team, we are definitely there to fight with you.
Great. And I would also want to add one from the GP world of things. Please cut down on, for those of you, if you know that you may have some of those modifiable risk factors that you can certainly modify, the reduction of alcohol, the reduction in smoking, and getting out there and exercise. I know that most people actually don't like to exercise, but it is a necessary good that we must perform. For those of you who are enduring during this heat at this point in time, I say try to get up a little earlier or do your exercise in the evening, or even try an indoor workout. There's really no excuse not to keep moving. Hydrate, not just water. Make sure you're getting in your electrolytes and continue to stay safe out there. Dr. Spring, I want to say thank you very much. Wait, hold one second. I'm seeing Gregson here telling me, don't go just yet. Yes, please, Gregson. Oh,
yeah, she's asking very kindly, so I think we can accommodate her in a couple of minutes. So,
definitely.
Yeah, okay, no caller, problem. Can you hear us?
Yes, please.
Yes, go right ahead with your question quickly, please.
Okay, so I was asking with regards to the tumor markers. If you have a CA-153 and CA-125 that's above 10, I saw on the internet that it means that you have some form of disease. So I was wondering, for such a patient who has like CA-153 and CA-125, if it's above 10 units per mil, right? When the reference range is like about 0 to 27.9 or 0 to 35 for CA-153 and CA-125 respectively, what measures do we take after that?
Right. So in terms of tumor markers, right, and just again for the public who may not know, these are chemicals or substances in the blood that cancers produce that we can measure. Yeah, so you've mentioned two just now, CA-125, which is associated with ovarian cancer, and CA-153, which is associated with breast cancer, right? But the thing is, they are not specific, yes? So every cancer will not produce the CA-153 or the CA-125, yes? So we don't do them then to screen for cancer. So we don't do them as screening tests, because it can be elevated or it can be normal in persons who have cancer. Yeah, so if it's normal, it doesn't mean you don't have cancer. If it's elevated, it doesn't mean you have cancer either. We use it for patients who we know have cancer if the cancer produces this chemical. So when the cancer produces this chemical, yeah, we can then follow our treatment. So if you say you have a cancer of the breast that is producing CA-153 and it starts off at 100, if I do a treatment on you, it's supposed to be curative, it will go into the normal range because I've removed all the cancer cells that was producing that chemical. Yeah, and I follow you. And if I see it going back up again into the range outside of normal, that may suggest that you have a recurrence, and then I look for it. But if you are a patient out there, we normally wouldn't do a CA-153 on you to see if you have breast cancer or not, because it's so non-specific. We would normally go to the organ and check, and that's where we do our mammograms and ultrasound.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I think what you... Mm-hmm.
And Dr. Spring, if I can jump in here just to add some more clarity to her situation, you said it's non-specific. There are other non-cancerous conditions that can cause elevation in CA, for instance, CA-153, to use as an example. Perfect with a lady with pelvic inflammatory disease, liver disease, endometriosis, even in pregnancy, you can have an elevated 153. So to blindly, unless there is some reason, go and take a 15-3 without any reason in terms of increased risk, you're following a cancer and you want to see how it's responding to treatment, it may not give you the answer that you want and also cause a lot of undue panic.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Yes, please. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You're very welcome, my dear. I think we did a good deed on that last one there. We snuck her in.
Yes.
And we got through. So over to you as we bring it to an end, Doc.
Yes, please. So Dr. Spring, I want to say thank you very much. Thank you for taking time out of your very busy schedule to join us this evening and really enlighten our public about breast cancer and the road that persons can take to screening, and certainly to understand that they do have the support in Barbados, in little tiny Barbados, but we do have good specialists out there that can assist persons on this journey, both in the public and private system. And I want to say thank you so much for joining us this evening.
Thank you very much for having me. You have a good afternoon. Good evening.
And to our wider public, Barbados, I want to say thank you once again. Gregson, thank you for offering us support. And I am going to hand right back over to you.
Thank you so much. That's Dr. Adanna Grandison, your presenter this evening for the Better Health Radio Show. And her guest this evening was Dr. Dale Springer. Next weekend, join us again for another edition. Until then, have a wonderful evening from the Better Health Radio Show.
Bye-bye.
All right. Take care.